When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the College Football Survivor Show, where playoff survival is always on the line. Here's Shahan Jeharaja and Babak Hayeri.
Hey everybody, it's the College Football Survivor Show. I'm Babak Hayeri with my co-host Shahan Jeharaja, national college football writer for CBS Sports. We're glad to have you with us. It's May. The traditional doldrums of our beloved sport begin now, but one thing I can say, it's a whole lot more exciting in recent years than it's been in the past. The portal, NIL, personalities, it's become a year-round thing, and I love it. It can be a little tough to cover because the breaks really aren't there like they used to be, but I'm glad we have material to discuss. And today, we're going to take stock and have a little bit of fun. With apologies to Washington, the spring game season is over. We've had a chance to see a little bit about what these teams are about, or at least what they'd like to reveal to us. The portal is still lingering, I'm going to note this, we're recording this on Wednesday. Technically, the portal ended yesterday, but the paperwork and the administrative stuff, we could get some stories that come out in the next couple of days. But for now, it's the time to take some stock and to make bold post-spring predictions for the upcoming season. We are the College Football Survivor Show, so who is ready to battle for those 12 spots? Who's a pretender? Listen in and find out. But before we dive in, let me remind you that you can find us on X and TikTok at CFB Survivor Show, where we have video highlights of the show, run polls, and listen to your feedback. Take a moment, if you can, to like, rate, and subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. But before we get started, and this is one of these stories that starts quietly and just keeps getting bigger to the point where we were like, yeah, we should probably talk about this one. Deion Sanders, and I love just starting out with that name. It's just like, like throwing that down. For those who have not been paying attention to what's been going on, or maybe have heard it in the background and not really sure what's going on, I'll just give you a really quick 411. So on Monday, The Athletic published an article by Max Olson entitled, "What Happened to Deion Sanders' Colorado Castoffs? Revisiting a Record-Setting Exodus," which, good article, I thought, especially the concept, because a year ago, we were all having the conversation of, wow, this massive exodus, this massive rebuilding at Colorado, where 53 players leave. Some of them were pushed out. Some of them decided to leave and saw the writing on the wall. So it was an article kind of tracking what happened to most of them. And they had conversations with some of the players. And it was, I thought overall, because it's so funny, I read this article when it came out. And I'm like, okay, all right, you know, it's fairly balanced. Some players were upset. Some were more kind of, you know, pensive about the whole thing. They had some quotes. I mean, there was a Chase Sowell, who's now a wide receiver at ECU. He's like, you know, I don't think he was being, you know, I won't use the word, but a jerk about it. I think he was just being straight up, prove me you can play, and he didn't sugarcoat it. Some players were more upset, like Xavier Smith, who's now at Austin Peay. You know, we sat on the sofa. He's talking to us, but not even looking to us. He was more upset. And, you know, he's like, you know, I was getting frustrated with the situation. He had even tears coming to his eyes. But he even then said, like, I wasn't shocked I was cut given my injury history. So it was an interesting article. You know, I read it. I'm sure a lot of people did who subscribed to The Athletic. But then, and there's layers to this, because this gets into how, as a public, we consume sports media and really all media, quite frankly. So The Athletic, it's a good article. They tweeted out. The tweet has an image of some of the hottest takes, or not hottest takes, but the strongest wording in this particular article. So it has Xavier Smith's quote, "I was actually getting mad, like tears coming to my eyes, because bro, you never even tried to get to know me." And another quote, "He was destroying guys' confidence and belief in themselves." So I have to say, from a marketing standpoint, my goodness, you will get people's attention if you throw those things into a nice image and tweet it with a link to the article. But this is the internet. And The Athletic is a subscription service, just like many other websites. People are hooking into that tweet. So all the responses started to come to that particular tweet, not the full story. I am from Reddit. That sounds weird to say that, but you know, I moderate the college football section of Reddit. But a running gag on Reddit is no one ever reads the articles. People just read the headlines, and we have a giant fight in the discussion boards over those headlines. And that's what we saw, especially on Twitter. So begun the tweet wars have in the days since. Shador responded to Xavier Smith with a tweet saying, "I don't even remember him, to be honest. Bro had to be very mid at best." Quote tweeting that particular Athletic article. Shador then last night, Tuesday, led a Twitter space with some of his cohorts, you know, linemen Khalil Benson and Justin Mayers. They were talking down Smith's college stats and his move up to the move to the G5, which is a little ironic because Justin Mayers started at UTEP. We'll set that aside for a second. They accused him of lying for clicks. And they even went after Maddox Olson, because why? Go after the messenger. You know, that's a classic thing in journalism, right? You know, they noted that he graduated from Nebraska, which is a Buffalo's rival. And to be fair, those are hated rivals. I see why they tried that angle. But they then admit that they didn't read the article itself. So you just have to love this. And then, again, you know, fine. All right. You see that it was easy to ignore it. And then came Wednesday morning. So Wednesday morning, Deion decides to reply a couple of things on Twitter. To some of the people criticizing him. Somebody, you know, tell your son to stop acting like he's the coldest out there and put up, you know, he put up a 4-8 season. To Deion decides to reply after this, he'll be a top 5 pick. Where is your son going? LOLOL, I got time today. LOLOL. I have to credit Freezing Cold Takes, Old Takes Exposed, one of those sites. I know the guy who runs it. He's a good guy. He actually replied to the tweet just to tell people, like, look, I'm not editorializing this. I don't know if this is going to be a freezing cold take or not. But everyone, please stop forwarding me this tweet. I got it. You know, I am aware of this tweet's existence. We'll get back to it if we need to. And then again, things just kept snowballing. So Deion Sanders replied to someone else, because one of the critiques was coming out of another Austin Peay player, Jaheim Ward. And he just wrote, "Law Jesus," you know, L-A-W-D, you know, Jesus, to a tweet of the stats of this other player. To which, of course, the player, Jaheim Ward, replied saying, "It's crazy I got more pass deflections than your son." So this is getting personal. And then, again, he has absolutely, to be fair, and again, I apologize. Hans is sitting there watching me go off on all of this, just trying to bring everyone up to speed. But Deion is clearly enjoying this moment because he's been having some fun retweeting, quote tweeting things that kind of basically show that this is his element and he's having fun with it. But all of that said, bringing everyone up to speed, because this story just keeps going on and on. And I've got his Twitter account like in the side of my computer screen, because who knows what's going to happen next. What's your take on this? Comments?
Well, I'll tell you what. I think from my perspective, the thing that, like, this is just beneath a power conference football coach, right? Like to get into a Twitter war with an FCS football player. And, you know, credit to Jaheim Moore, by the way, for like standing up for his guy. Scotty Walden, who was his coach at Austin Peay, did the same thing. Now his coach at UTEP as well, essentially said, like, "I'll ride with him any day. He's the furthest thing from soft." Like we mentioned, I mean, this kid who we're talking about, he ended up being a leader for that Austin Peay team, which won their conference that year and was a four-team freshman All-American, you know, was recognized, did a great job, had some pretty good offers coming back up, but decided to stay with his coach, Scotty Walden, heading to UTEP because he had a really great relationship with him. Like, this just feels so beneath the coach. And for me, like, there's so much in the bigger Deion world and context that we can talk about, and I really want to mostly keep it to football, right? Because I think that it's easy to get lost in all this other stuff. From my perspective, I think that the most newsworthy thing from the story is sort of the slash and burn level with which Colorado attacked its roster last year. And I think, look, they were a 1-11 team. I don't think by any means anybody on the roster had to be sacred, right? Like, there was nobody really on the roster who just had to be retained, had to be kept, whatever. But I think in their aggression in some ways, they might have cut some players who ended up being pretty good. And the other piece too, and I think that this kind of gets at my big picture Deion ethos when it comes to Colorado, is a lot of what he said in the past couple of weeks is, well, we don't really feel like we're losing anything. That guy wasn't going to be a starter anyway. And I think that when other coaches around college football, whether head coaches or position coaches, look at that, they kind of see it as missing the point, right? Because the question isn't, will this individual player be a star and a starter for you right now? Which, by the way, they did lose some guys who were slated to be starters and returning starters in 2024. But even more than that, you're in a position where, like, nobody's allowed to become a good player. Nobody's allowed to improve. Nobody's allowed to develop into being a good player. And I wrote a story about this actually last Friday, specifically talking about Colorado's offensive line, because Colorado essentially told the vast majority of the two deep from the 2022 season to get lost. And sure, fine, whatever. A couple of them actually ended up at pretty good schools. A couple of them started games for power conference programs. But okay, they brought back, I believe it was two starters primarily from that 2022 team. They started a bunch of games. And everybody else was run off. Well, they brought in 9 linemen in the class of 2023. 7 of those guys are no longer on the roster either, right? Between graduations, between transfers. So, like, this is just a fundamental question of, can you create an entire football roster of guys that are, for lack of a better phrase, instant gratification, right? That are in, like, that need to be good in 2024, because there is really no future after that. They don't have a plan for after Shedeur Sanders graduates. They don't have a plan for after Travis Hunter graduates. They don't have a plan for when Shiloh Sanders leaves, right? Like, that's fundamentally my thing is, when you look at what Colorado did last year, going from 1-11 to 4-8 is a perfectly fine first year for a first-year coach taking over a tough situation. But the idea that we need to treat it like it's something that it's not is where I get frustrated. You know, there were 3 programs that play in a conference. I put UMass to the side because, like, they're just kind of floating in their old world right now. There were 3 programs that play in an FBS conference that went 1-11 in 2022. Colorado, Northwestern, and South Florida. And those other 2 programs both made bowl games. David Braun put together one of the most impressive first seasons by an interim head coach that I've ever seen. And Alex Golish took South Florida back to a bowl game in his first year. I don't see these conversations happening from David Braun, right? Like, which would be a reasonable thing to do, to say, I came into a program that was 1-11, that was a total mess, that was dealing with a coach who was beloved, who was pushed out and took on one of the worst situations that anybody had to deal with last year in college football. And I made a freaking bowl game in the Big Ten, by the way. Like, we're not having that conversation because we have to talk about this. And I'm just, at a certain point, like, there are some things that I'm interested in. I've said, I think that they have a good chance to make a bowl next year. And let's say that they get to 6, right? Like, going from 1-11 to 4-8 to 6-6, like, that is a reasonably good trajectory. Making a bowl at Colorado is not nothing. But does it deserve all of this? Does it deserve all this attention? Does it deserve, completely ridding the deck of 60% of your 2023 recruiting and signing class? Does it completely mean that you should just get rid of any developmental piece or any amount of depth that you have on the roster? Does it warrant all of that? And that's just where I come back to. I just can't see why this is so worth our time that we need to talk about it all the time.
One other thing I think it distracts from, if we're really getting into kind of the pure football, or at least how you run a program, is I think it's still a little early to judge how a very radical approach Deion's taking to building a program, if it's a success or not. There was incremental success last year. I mean, again, if it hadn't been Deion, if Colorado had hired a coach who went from, you know, 1 win to 4 wins, people would be like, okay, all right, let's see how year 2, year 3 goes. But obviously the Deion Sanders thing is just such a big story in and of itself. But taking this radical maneuver to being willing to just rip things down, clearly now we see from just even year to year within the same program, is utterly fascinating. And we're seeing this being run on an FBS level. Because, I mean, we've occasionally seen some pretty odd ideas. Like, I don't know, for some people may recall this, but a couple of years ago, FCS Presbyterian, they hired the guy who never punts. And their games were, I mean, I didn't watch any of them, but the actual box scores were either, they were swings for hitting something out of the park or complete disaster. And he did not last the season. But, you know, usually it's at that level, you'll see something where you're like, wow, let's see how this experiment runs. And instead, we're seeing it at the highest level. Well, not the highest level. I mean, Alabama ain't going to let him do that. But, you know, still, Colorado is not a team to completely disregard in this. So we are seeing how it works. And there's so many questions there. Like, everyone's waiting to see after next season. Shador is going to be in the draft when he's gone, when his sons are no longer there. Is he just going to leave the program? And what's the next person going to be left with? A lot of questions there. And I mean, I'm not going to. It's entertaining, you know, again, that gets kind of a little outside of the nuts and bolts. But for me, it is utterly fascinating to watch this experiment go. And it was going to get people upset one way or another. There were going to be players who were upset. There were players, as you noted, who saw the way the program was being run. And they're kind of like, I haven't been cut, but I don't really want to be here anymore. And to which, of course, you know, and I think maybe that's part of what's rubbing people the wrong way. It's a kind of like, I guess I can't cut, you know, I'm not, that's not how he says it, but like, he's absolutely saying, you know, they can't hack it here. Guess I'll move somewhere else, you know, and I get it. It's a bold way to do it. It's rubbing some people the wrong way. And I am utterly fascinated to see how this is going to go. And one of the things, by the way, one of the things I noted when I was looking at some of these tweets, just to kind of go over how things had gone, you know, The Athletic had a good amount of people seeing that one tweet I was mentioning, you know, 8.8 million impressions. That's good. But then, you know, Shador Sanders quote tweet where he says, like, I don't even remember this guy. He was admitted best, had 16 million views. Prime's tweets are all doing really, you know, a lot of attention. So it really kind of goes to a very unique situation. It's just, we've never had a coach that is a complete magnet for everything that is going on here. Because this is a story in and of itself. I mean, as I've noted before, Texas State is the other team that really redid their roster. And they came pretty close to not quite the Deion numbers, but they also came pretty close to a high number. And they quietly went to the first bowl the Bobcats have ever gone to. So can the system work like that? I'm not sure. It's TBD. The Bobcats certainly haven't done it again this season. They kind of did a rebat, and they seem to have stuck together at least for now. But man, I'm very curious to see where this goes. This is,
yeah. And so there's two things that I want to say. One to do with football, and one kind of more off field. So to do the off field first, I think what people need to understand about this is that this is an NFL story, right? Like, this is a celebrity culture story. This is not a college football story, and that's why the discourse in so many ways is so insane. Like, you have to make the comparison in some ways to, like, Caitlin Clark in women's basketball, where all of a sudden these people who don't necessarily know much about women's basketball are showing up and trying to tell everybody what's what, and trying to be like, well, Caitlin Clark's the first great player in the history of women's basketball because they didn't actually watch whenever Candace Parker or Lisa Leslie or Tamika Catchings or any of these people were coming through, right? Like, they're new to it. So you do have to have that piece of context. But it's also notable, even when you look at, like, the ratings of the Colorado games last season, like, the NFL is so much bigger than college football. I think that people who love college football, and I grew up in an NFL market, right? I'm in Dallas. But, like, I don't think that people in college football understand just how much bigger the NFL is than college football. Where, like, this guy who was a star and a personality in college football is a mainstream celebrity in a way that college people just usually aren't. I mean, when we talk about the most famous people in college football, like, in any capacity, I mean, like, Johnny Manziel, yeah, he's the closest did some I of that. Of. Yeah, that's the closest, and that was back in 2012 that all of this was going on. But it's just not normal. I mean, we get, like, some glimpses of it with, like, the Zion thing, but even that I don't think is quite like this. And so, like, that's a big part of all of this. And honestly, one thing is I got to be better about, I don't need to well actually everybody, man. I need to get better about not well actualing every single wrong thing that people are saying because they don't actually know college football. I need to get better about that. But to take it back to the football thing, I'm glad you actually brought up Texas State and GJ Kinney. The way that he is doing stuff is more how I expected Deion Sanders to do stuff, which is to say, and I want to be clear, the issue is not that Colorado tried to flip their roster. Like, that is not an issue. Yeah, I think that we can have a conversation about, like, not necessarily doing the greatest job of evaluating what you have, you know, coming in and kind of isolating people from the start and how that sets up, like, your team culture. And, it, like, I think those are all conversations we can have. Cutting 53 players or whatever it was, like, that's obviously a little crazy, but, like, okay. If you want to try that, then okay, try it. My bigger thing with Colorado projecting forward is when you look at G.J. Kinney, he said, I'm going to come in and I'm going to kind of wipe the deck in some ways. And they had a lot of transfers out anyway, but I'm going to wipe the deck. I'm going to bring in this huge transfer class. And that's going to be my new foundation of players. And I'm going to recruit high school players on top of that. I'm going to retain. Like, when you talk about the, I think Texas State brought in like 40 transfer players. It was a lot of players. It was a lot. But what they ended up doing was they tried to balance their transfer class so that they're kind of replacing, like, okay, here's the freshman numbers that we need. Here's the sophomore numbers that we need. So that they're kind of rebuilding a traditional style of roster. Well, with Colorado, it was all, we want to bring in exclusively guys who are going to contribute right now. We're going to bring in 70 new players, and we expect 60 of them to play right now. And when that didn't happen, 60% of them ultimately left the program. And so where I have issue and where I have, or more where I have question than issue, is can you continually do that? Can you wipe the deck a second time and only benefit from it? Because, you know, we talk about rebuilds, and like I said, 1-11 to 4-8, that's an upward trajectory. I think that that's a totally fair thing to say. But is it a trajectory if your roster isn't even coming back? If you have no returning production, essentially, for your second season? I think that that's where I am fascinated. And you lose, I mean, they lost their entire running back room, and they bring in two really good players in Rashad Amos and Dallin Hayden, but, like, you lost your whole running back room. You've lost three starting offensive linemen. And from a talent perspective, sure, like, Jordan Seaton's coming in, Peyton Kirkland's coming in. These are talented players who have never played college football before. So, like, can you just completely wipe the deck and have it be marginal improvement? I don't really know. We've never seen it. And the fact that we haven't seen it doesn't mean that it can't be done, certainly. But all the data that we have right now is what we have. And it is that a team went 4-8 last year and then lost a ton of production, that they return no starting offensive linemen from last season, that they have to replace their whole running back room and lost 60% of the Louis baggage that came in from last season. Like, so I don't know how to evaluate how this is going in any sort of way that makes me feel good about where they're at. And that's ultimately what it comes down to.
Can I ask you just one kind of question, more on a macro level of the work of a journalist? Because I think Max Olson did a decent article. But is it frustrating for you when sometimes, and I mean, I'm not going to point fingers or even where you might have worked, because you worked at multiple places, when a piece you write takes on a completely weird life of its own because of a headline? And I know most of the time, because I've written before, headlines aren't things that you usually control. I mean, gosh, way back in the day when I was a grad student, I wrote a parody article about people who wanted to go to law school. I said, like, here's all, I was like every nightmare, but it was written in a very dry, sarcastic tone. And I was a humor columnist. But the student editor who was an undergrad wrote career advice. That was the title. So the entire tone of the article when people were reading it, I was getting emails from around the, I don't know how this thing got spread around because this is before social media. I got articles from around, pardon me, emails from around the country, like, what's wrong with you? Why are you scaring people from being lost? I'm like, it was a humor article. Like, they gave it a title that made it sound serious. Have you ever, like, so that's, I think, where I'm coming at when I read, like, you know, Olson getting attacked and all these things as an author. Is that a frustration for you? Have you ever had to deal with that in your career?
I've had to deal with it specifically because I've had articles posted on Reddit before, in fact.
Oh, we're a nice place. No, we're not.
No, but it's interesting, right? Because, like you said, at this level, writers don't write headlines. Editors write headlines. The other thing, too, though, is that I mean, I don't think that the headline on Max Olson's article was that bad, right? Like, what happened to Deion Sanders' Colorado castoffs revisiting a record-setting exodus? That's pretty straightforward.
Yeah, it was actually
great. The Athletic
is
pretty good. Yeah, the Athletic is pretty good about actually framing what happens. I mean, I think that, again, like, if I'm Max, and I know Max a little bit, like, I'm sure that my frustration is that these kids who didn't really do anything wrong except talk honestly about their experience, like Xavier Smith, that their quote was kind of stolen from a much larger picture and turned into something that it never was. Now, Xavier Smith seems to be taking it in stride. Actually, I saw Chase Sowell, another player who was mentioned in the article. He also kind of was like, I was just speaking basically the truth, and not everybody's going to be happy with it, but I'm comfortable with it. But like, that would be my biggest frustration, is like these kids who just were being honest about their experience, mm-hmm. and telling their story, kind of being attacked in an out of context way, and acting like, and again, like you said, this article was really well done. I mean, whatever, Max Olson went to Nebraska. I promise he does not care. Yeah. Max Olson went to Nebraska in like the late 2000s, if I remember right. I don't think that there were many Colorado-Nebraska battles that mattered all that much to Max Olson when he was in college. Just to put that aside, and actually, even to go back on it, it's a little funny. I realize that I just have on like a Baylor sweatshirt because like that's just what I wear around the house sometimes. But like, this idea that writers, especially ones who are more in like multidisciplinary national roles, care about like their school's rivalry when they're setting this stuff up is so wild to me. Like, you know who wrote like closer and better than almost any other national writer about TCU's trip to the national championship game? Was this guy. Because like, I know this program in a unique way because I've been around it. And part of that is the advantage of like being in the Big 12 and having gone to school there and having that context. I wrote very closely about Texas. I would argue that I knew Texas as well as almost anybody heading into last year. That's obviously a program that Baylor fans hate, but like, I know it and I've covered it and I know people in that program. And so like, the idea that Max Olson wrote a quote unquote hit piece where he asked some players some pretty milquetoast questions about their experience because he went to Nebraska, like, get over yourself. I think that the other part of this too is that people are so obsessed with kind of their own heads, right? They're like, well, if I was a Colorado fan and I was writing about Nebraska, then I'd try to write some hating stuff. And it's like, yeah, that's why you don't have this job, and Max Olson does, because he's a professional. And even, I mean, again, like I've talked about, I still have a relationship with Baylor University. I met my wife there, right? Like my baby daughter has some Baylor stuff, but it's like, the idea that I even like feel anything when it comes to Baylor football is just like, I don't know, man, I went 3-9 last year. I had a great year. Like, I know people from every staff. I like, there are people like, really, when you get to this level too, there's a level of like, there are people that you like and think do things the right way and root for, and people that you aren't so sure about, and people who have wronged you potentially or whatever it is. Right. And like, that's way more like the individual relationship aspect ends up being so much more significant to shaping our coverage. Also, by the way, the fact that I watch 134 FBS teams and can kind of draw conclusions based off of that. So anyway, this is all such bad faith, obviously. Like, the idea of Shedeur Sanders and all of them kind of dragging Max Olson's name in a whatever, a Twitter space, like, come on, man. Like, that's just so crazy to me. And this isn't how big time programs operate.
Yeah.
And yeah, you know, you're going to have people who want to kind of jump on and jump in. Like, I think that that's absolutely real, right? The idea that like, some people are going to be attracted to this, and to an extent, right? It's protecting your own, and it's kind of standing up for yourselves in kind of your own way. But like, the thing that happens is that when you are outside of it, then it flips in a second, right? Like, I think this is in some ways what happened to Cormani McClain, who ended up transferring from Colorado. He thought that he was going to get to be Travis Hunter, that he was going to be like walking fashion week with Shadur and Travis Hunter, right? And as soon as you're not viewed as the same as them, then it kind of flips on you. That's kind of the downside to it. And, you know, there was this quote, Bud Elliott, my colleague over at 247, he actually had a quote from a mom of one of the top players in the class of 2025, who, after all this happened, she kind of quote tweeted and was like, "This is beyond disgusting. This is how a leader of a team behave. This is what the University of Colorado promotes." Like, so the idea that this is just like Twitter brain people only who are noticing this stuff and not liking the general tenor of it, I think is a little short-sighted. And it hasn't been a secret that Colorado and Deion Sanders' staff has not been pounding the pavement on the recruiting trail and hasn't really tried to go about things that way, as opposed to like make some big swings in high school recruiting and hope that attracts other people to come as well. Like, I'm curious. Again, I want to see indicators. If I see indicators that this is working, I will change my tune immediately. When Colorado went and upset TCU last year, it made me rethink everything that I thought about mm-hmm. what Colorado was doing. I didn't change my mind completely, but I was like, oh, this is not what I expected necessarily. Let me keep an eye on it and let me try to reevaluate my priors. But then all of my priors over the course of a 12-game season came true. And that's what it comes down to at the end of it. And we can kind of wrap up this conversation with that. The job of an analyst or a journalist or a writer or whatever is to look at the information that they have and make evaluations based off of it. And right now, the data that we have is not good.
Absolutely. And one note, of course, talking about that TCU game, Dylan Edwards was a great part of that offense, and now he's going to Kansas State. So there we go. I do want to say, though, and I will caution just everyone involved in this, all of the players from all of the teams, former Colorado, current Colorado, and then the others chiming in, they're all still young. So I would caution a little bit of patience with them than versus the adults in this, the older adults. Let's just say older
100%
in this conversation.
100%.
But at the same time, I'm going to say the NFL draft, they are going to be looking, those teams are going to be looking at how some of these guys are behaving. So we'll see how much of an impact that makes. Oh, my God. And one last note. I only have to say, it reminds me of when any of these legal cases are going on. Oh, the judge went to such and such school. And I'm like, wow, I'm going to say this much. Anyone in the practice of law, you could run into some trouble. And I mean, lay people are fine, but my goodness, you could get in some trouble if you start accusing judges of bias just because they happen to go to a law school that's associated with the university. First of all, like, you go to law school, unless you went there for undergrad, you're kind of, related to the school.
You're not a diehard Gophers fan now?
There aren't some insane. Well, let's put it this way: the Harvard Crimson don't have a bunch of lawyers necessarily as their biggest boosters. You know, they went to Harvard Law School because they went to Harvard Law School. You know, great Yale Law School, wonderful. But I'm not saying they're necessarily going there hardcore. You know,
I did have a conversation with somebody yesterday because like some Harvard basketball players have entered the portal, and it's so hard, of course, for Harvard to get transfers. It's because like you have to transfer into Harvard academically. It's really hard. But the hilarious thing is like they were kind of having this conversation of like, well, you know, there's kind of been this idea that if Harvard or like these Ivy League schools decided to be serious about NIL, like that, the two things that people don't understand about this is, one, rich Harvard grads don't fund FCS football programs. They like buy the Los Angeles Chargers. Like, it is a different level of wealth. They don't give a damn about no NIL. Are you kidding me right now? Like, they're not wasting their time with that. They are on a completely different level of wealth. And two, like you said, I mean, if you go to Harvard Law, Harvard Business School, whatever, It's just not part of the experience in the same way as like you went to USC. Like, that was a big part of the experience. I went to Baylor. It's a big part of the experience. Go to any Big Ten or Big 12 or SEC or Sun Belt. Like, it's part of the experience. I mean, like, yeah, people show up for like the tailgates at the Harvard game, but like, come on, people don't care like that about where they go to law school
and
like the football program or basketball program that's there.
But it's funny to see it because it definitely comes up. And oh my goodness, I've seen judges have lose their judgeship because of things that you're just like, that was bias. And then you're like, I guess it was, you know? So, I mean, like when you're going that path, oof, well, you know, we've certainly expended plenty of time on this topic. So when we come back, we're going to take a look back to the spring game, the post spring game world, and give some of our bold predictions for the upcoming season here on the College Football Survivor Show.
The College Football Survivor Show, where playoff survival is always on the line.
This episode is supported by FX's Clipped, the scandalous story of the 2014 Clippers owner's racist remarks captured on tape and heard around the world. The series charts the tape's impact on a dysfunctional basketball organization striving to win against their reputation as the most cursed team in the league. Starring Lawrence Fishburne, Jackie Weaver, Cleopatra Coleman, and Ed O'Neill. FX's Clipped, streaming June 4th, only on Hulu.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Well, spring games are over. Let's have a quick look at what we think. I mean, we're going to have some fun with this. I mean, everyone's making the traditional views, and some people haven't. I haven't seen yet a post-spring top 25. I'm sure they're coming because that's the next wave of things. Maybe next week we'll have one of our own. Who knows? But as far as what we've seen here in the spring, what are some of your bold takes on where things are going?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I think my number one bold take is that we are headed to an Ohio State-Georgia national championship game. And other teams have a chance to get into the mix. There's no doubt about it. But when you look at what Georgia has continually built and how good Carson Beck looks. And by the way, Dominic Lovett at receiver had a bit of a down year last year after transferring from Missouri, but I think that this is his moment to step up and become a huge player. I think they just got it in the SEC. Now, I think that there's one team from each conference that I think could potentially add some complication, and that's Oregon from the Big Ten, that's Texas from the SEC. But I think these are the two best teams in college football. I've said it from the beginning. When you look defensively at Ohio State, I actually was going back through some numbers. Ohio State has had three total defensive players picked in the NFL draft since 2021. That's just crazy. With the level of talent that they continually bring in and put out, and only one of those players was a top three round pick, and that was Zach Harrison at defensive end, who was picked in the third round. So this is a year where, like, you start looking at next year, there's going to be a lot of NFL talent coming out from Ohio State, including on the defensive side of the ball. JT Tuimoloau, potentially a top 10 pick at defensive end. Jack Sawyer probably would have been picked this year had he come out. Caleb Downs won't be draft eligible as yet, but he's, of course, a top 10 pick at safety. Denzel Burke could develop into that first-round corner that they haven't had in a little while. CJ Hicks, you know, there's a lot of good players, I think, on this Ohio State defense. And offensively, look, I didn't love the spring from Ohio State, to be honest. But, you know, offensive line, quarterback, those are the two things I have questions about. But you kind of trust Ryan Day to figure it out. Like, offense really isn't like the big question mark for Ohio State heading into next year. So if their defense is ready to roll under a great defensive coordinator in Jim Knowles, who I've spoken a lot about over the years, I think it's Ohio State, Georgia. I don't know if there's a team that can knock us off that path.
I think it's the safest bet. And I think there's a lot of reasons to like that. And I mean, the joke is, like, I was kidding with someone. Ohio State only had 4 NFL draft picks this year. I mean, it's because they all stayed. I want to say there's another team that kind of falls into that because there was a headline like Nebraska didn't have anyone picked them. Like, it's because they all stayed, and Matt Rule's probably going to look a lot better next season because of that. But then there's other teams that have, like, then the opposite side of that, USC had 7 picks, which only frustrates people. Like, 2 of them were defenders, which tells you how much. Actually, that is the USC that I went to school at. I remember the LA Times put it best. USC, all talent, no results. That was their preseason prediction. And I'm like, yep, we're back to that era again. But going back to predictions here, I decided who could be the potential challengers here. Georgia, in my mind, is the toughest one to set aside. And I don't think Alabama is going to be the challenger. I just think there's too much rebuilding there. But based on the spring, Texas is the safer bet as the challenger. I agree. Because of who they're bringing back, because of Quinn Ewers, if he can get consistency, they're going to be potentially unstoppable. They were able to reload on the wide receiver with Isaiah Bond. They've got good people there overall. But I think Ole Miss could be the big surprise. And the problem is we didn't get to see Ole Miss because Ole Miss was doing Lane Kiffin things and they had the Grove game. So we only saw a tug of war. We didn't see a slam dunk contest. We don't know what to make of them, but they brought back Jackson Dart. They've got Trey Harris, Jordan Watkins, Caden Prieskorn. Henry Parrish, as expected, came back to be their running back, especially if they lost Quinshon Judkins. Logan Diggs could get healthy and be another great running back for them. Walter Nolan's there as a defense. I mean, if Ole Miss gets things to click, I think we're too busy thinking of them like we're thinking of Penn State. Like, they're just going to be happy to make the playoff. You know, like, the 12-team playoff was made for those two teams in particular. But I think if I'm going to go bold, I think Ole Miss might be the team that shocks people and puts a scare in Georgia. They could be the team because everyone's going to be paying attention to the new guys. Texas is here. Oklahoma, people are like, well, Oklahoma could be better than expected. You know, I mean, we're hearing a lot of conversation about them. And I think Lane really wanted this. He wanted to be, you know, well, maybe we'll see the classic Lane Kiffin trajectory. Being quiet, then when they start to do a little well, he's going to start talking some crap right before a big game. And then if history goes the way it goes, then he flops in that big game and everyone's like, it's Ole Miss being Ole Miss. But I think this might be the year. If I'm going to be bold, this could be the year where Ole Miss surprises people because the talent is hard to avoid. And for that reason. Now, meanwhile, the Big Ten, I had a hard time not picking against Oregon. I think Oregon is going to be the main challenger. That October 12th game, where if we don't have game day at undefeated Ohio State visiting undefeated Oregon and Autzen, I don't know. Somebody's in a lot of trouble somewhere. That's all. I don't know which team it would be. I don't know which team. And another team, meanwhile, is going to be a Cinderella season. Like, even if they lost the subsequent games, they're going to be talking about them. Like, oh, my God, did you see they knocked off one of those two teams? But especially, you know, when you listen to how that spring game went, they had the takeaway was not just the transfers, because obviously you have Dylan Gabriel. You have a lot of talented wide receivers there that are already there, but the depth on defense is going to keep them in games. They're going to be ready to play in the Big Ten. And I think part of the reason, and I don't think Ohio State's looking past the Ducks. I'm not stupid enough to make that kind of a claim. But we all know who Ohio State's squarely planning to beat into oblivion this season, and that is the rebuilding job at Michigan. And Michigan's no one, I think, is expecting them to necessarily be a contender for the Big Ten. But I do wonder if so much attention has been, this is Ohio State's year to get past Michigan, that they're forgetting Oregon is coming in. And I think Oregon being at home, hosting Ohio State, no one would be shocked if they pull that upset. And I think if they do, the whole college football world is going to be realizing that this is the duck season to light everything on fire. Beyond that, I think there's some overrated teams. I talked about Michigan. I think a little bit too much.
Is Michigan overrated, though? How rated do you think Michigan is?
People are putting them in their top 10. That's crazy to me. That's absolutely bonkers. I think their defense is going to be pretty good. I mean, they're bringing back guys like Will Johnson, Rod Moore, Mason Graham. They got some good guys in defense. But people were like, hey, Alex Orji was competent. I'm like, okay, cool. I don't know if that's what we're going for. I mean, the Donovan Edwards, if he looks like he did in that title game, that's going to be a great thing. We're going to see the Michigan offense get rolling. Certainly that the running game is Sean Moore's like bread and butter. But I'm worried that people are giving them too much of a bounce after last season. I could say the same thing about Washington. I mean, but I think especially Michigan, coming off of a national championship season, I'd need to see a lot more from them. And I think we're going to see a team that goes to a good bowl. But I'm worried when I see them appearing in the top 10. And maybe, again, when we start seeing some of these post-spring top 25s that are coming out there, we'll see a little bit more realistic expectations. But some of the beliefs for that team, I think, are going to set up for disappointment.
I think from my perspective, they are just going to have like the nicest, most okay 9-3. Of anybody in the country last year. I think that they are perfect at like number 17. That's probably about where I'd put them in my way too early rankings. They have four first round picks on their team right now. Will Johnson at cornerback, mm-hmm. like you mentioned, Kenneth Grant potentially joining Mason Graham at defensive tackle as a first round pick, and then Colston Loveland as well, somebody that people are very high on. We'll see if Donovan Edwards can get into the first two or three rounds too. That said, the schedule is interesting because Texas, Oregon, Ohio State, if things go as we expect, they probably shouldn't have, like, I'm not going to say they have no chance in those games, but like they're going to lose those games. Now, Michigan beating Ohio State next year would be one of the most insane things to ever happen ever. Like, that would be like, that would be like people in Ohio Stadium start tearing the bleachers apart.
There are going to be some Twitter spaces that are going to be epic. Oh. I will start one. I'm sure we'll see a lot like 11 Warriors and all those guys start them. Like, it will be unhinged. It will be spectacular.
Yeah. It'll be next level. But like after that, you know, they get USC at home. They go to Washington. They don't get Penn State on this schedule. I think that would have been a tricky game for them potentially. Like, I think that they can win all of the rest of their games without trying that hard. USC will be interesting. I think that they're going to be better than USC. And it's at home. If it was on the road, maybe I wouldn't feel quite as good about it. But I think it's going to be like a nice 9-3 and number 17 finish in the country. Although I will say too, if they finish 9-3 and their only losses are to like top six teams, I could see people trying to be like, no, they should be like number 11. They should be in the playoff. And I think that would not go the greatest for them. So I don't think that they will. But, Washington, of course, like you mentioned, a team that lost a lot. They bring in a new coaching staff. There's some chatter around town right now that Will Rogers might not win the starting job out of camp, that potentially freshman Damond Williams could be pushing him for that starting job. Their spring game, like you mentioned, isn't until Friday, so mm-hmm. It won't have happened by the time you're listening to this. So it'll be interesting to keep an eye on that one. I don't view them as a team that has a chance to be right. One team... Again, if we want to get back to sort of more bold predictions, like can Mario Cristobal mess up this Miami team?
They are. I'm glad he brought up Miami because they are
fascinating.
I think they could be the team of the ACC because I think Florida State's replacing just too many people. I it's great coaching staff, but I mean when you look at who they lost in the draft: Keon Coleman, Trey Benson, Jordan Travis, Johnny Wilson, Jaheim Bell. I'm like they. You got a D on that staff if you want to like get, you know, D on that program if you want to get a new offense, because that's a lot of losses. But I think Miami with Cam Ward, the people they have already there, like Xavier Restrepo, but bringing in Damian Martinez, bringing in Samuel Brown, like this offense, and their defense was not bad last season. Like they just had, we talked about it. Van Dyke just, he kind of wasn't the best at keeping the ball on their team, you know? If they can just get what the talent that they have just to produce, not even spectacular, just do what they're supposed to do, they're going to be potentially the favorite in the ACC. And I think they could go through the whole thing.
No, it's going to be fascinating because I think you look at that team, like you said, defensively, I think you just trust them enough. They're not going to be a bad unit, I don't think. So let's just say that they're above average. offensively, that firepower is crazy, man. Like Damian Martinez coming in from Oregon State, that is nuts. That is a crazy running back talent to get in the post-spring portal. Cam Ward is a player who I've talked about at length before. I absolutely love Cam Ward. Actually, by the way, Damian Martinez, too, a kid from Texas as well, right down the street from me in Louisville. But Sam Brown, it was a recent addition, like you mentioned, coming in from Houston. He actually led the team last year in receiving yards. And like you look at their schedule, at Florida that first week, it's not an anxiety bowl, but like they really should win that game. Like they should win that game. I think that it would be very disappointing if they don't win that game.
That actually, that I would say that fits into one of my other bold predictions, which is how long do we think Napier is going to be at Florida? Like when do you think that button's going to be the eject button is going to be hit? Because it could be before the end of September. It could be before the end of September.
We'll circle that schedule after we finish with Miami, but let's just say that they get Florida. Okay, so A&M, Florida A&M, sorry, Ball State at South Florida. Virginia Tech will be kind of the first interesting test at Cal. At Louisville versus Florida State, that'll be the two-game stretch that defines their season ultimately. The rest of the schedule, I mean, it's very manageable. Like it's kind of like in conference, there are three games that are even potentially losable, and that's about it. And they should, I think, win at least two of them. So they very well should be the team, I think, coming out of the ACC. I've talked about SMU before, too. I think that they're potentially going to be a contender as well. Miami misses SMU in the schedule. Florida State actually kind of gets everybody. They've got a bit of a tough road, actually, to try to contend in the ACC. So, like Miami, man, if you're going to make this work, you kind of got to make it happen right now.
Yeah, and I just... Shifting over to Florida, their schedule, I mean, much has been said about the back half, but I don't know how well they're going to do in the front. Because, I mean, we're talking about this Miami game, and it looks like Miami's going to be low. It's going to be an absolute stressor for everyone involved in those two teams. Miami fans want to see that they're as good as they hope they are, and the Florida teams just want to look like they're going to be able to survive and potentially, and I think winning that game is, I don't want to say it's a must win, but it's going to be a real cloud if they mess it up, because it's Miami, it's a rival. And then you know they get Samford, Texas A&M. Mike Elko could have that team in a place where they could potentially head into Gainesville and cause problems and potentially win. But then imagine if they go into Starkville and it's at Starkville. Imagine if they lose to Mississippi State. I don't think they would. I think Mississippi State and Vandy are going to be the weakest teams in the SEC, at least at this point. But man, are things going to go. And then there's so many games after it, which could cause more problems. I mean, UCF, I think people are overlooking them. I think there's enough there that they could win. And no team, I mean, there's a team that would love nothing more than to beat a team that is very close by, that they've lived in the shadow of for their entire existence. It's a good question on how soon they could lose. And who knows? I mean, I'm going to just say Billy Napier could surprise everyone and put together enough of a season. Because, I mean, he was great at Louisiana. I'm not going to say the Raging Cajuns looked great with him as a head coach. But this is a season. This is a defining season of whether he survives or doesn't as that head coach. And I'm not sure he could make it through. I'm to me, it's really it's almost like a Deadpool. Like, at what point are they going to pull the plug?
Well, and you mentioned UCF. They added Penny Boone, by the way, a transfer from the MAC as well. So their backfield is going to be freaking insane, to be honest. I actually have a whole article coming out the day that you're going to get this on Thursday on Big 12 overreactions over at CBS Sports. So I'm going to avoid the Big 12 for my kind of bold predictions right now. But make sure and check that out at cbssports.com. I think I'm into what USC is doing defensively. I think I'm into it. Now, I don't know what that means. I don't know if that's going to be enough. But like, I do think that when you look at the way that they've flown around in the spring and kind of just the way that they've approached things, the way that they've approached tackling, I think has just been a bit smarter. Like, I'm kind of into it. Now, the schedule, again, this is going to be a constant theme for some of these teams, especially, by the way, if you're in the SEC and the Big Ten now, like you probably just have a bad schedule. Like that's just probably, especially in the SEC, like the Big Ten, especially like Iowa. I don't know who Iowa bribed to get the three permanent rivalry games that are all pretty easy, but like, if you're in the SEC, you're in trouble every single year. That's just how it's going to be. Although Florida, you're in even more trouble than most. But, you know, USC in their first 3 weeks gets both LSU and at Michigan. So I think that there's two ways that this can go. One, it could just like be a disaster right away, right? Like it could just immediately become a disaster. Or these are two teams with very impressive names and brands that aren't actually going to be all that good next year. And USC will have a chance to pick up wins over quote unquote LSU and defending champion Michigan and rise to like number three in the polls. And maybe that's enough to like build them some confidence and momentum. Because again, like once you get later in the schedule, it's okay. Like they don't play a tough team until Penn State, which they get at home actually on that same October 12th. October 12th is actually going to be a pretty good day. You mentioned, of course, which game did you mention? It was the Ohio State Oregon game. Yeah, that's that day. Texas Oklahoma is that day. That's going to be a big game for Brent Venables to try and manage. But like the second half of the schedule, pretty manageable overall. You get Notre Dame the last week of the year. Like I don't think this is a playoff team, but if you start 3-0 and beat those two teams, I mean you might be coasting in some ways, right? Like you might be a 9-3, 10-2 team that just like will have done enough that people won't drop them even if they struggle later in the year.
Yeah, I think that USC-LSU game is going to give one team perhaps too big of an inflated reputation. It reminds me of two seasons ago with Texas A&M Miami, where everyone was like, Texas A&M's back. And then, no, not quite.
and then last year when we declared Miami back because they beat Texas A&M.
And then they proceed to forget how to knee a game to end it.
Yes. Yes.
You know, one team that I think is going to get a hype train that's going to go potentially out of control, especially after the spring, is Nebraska. Because Dylan Raiola, I still love one of my favorite reactions when someone posted his spring stats. Everyone loves spring stats, but, you know, it was a facetious comment because Nebraska fans are good about taking a little bit of wind out of their own sails. But he was like, we're never going to lose again. So I think that when you look at the schedule, and there's a couple of things here that are really going to get people, Nebraska, for all its foibles over the last however long it's been, it seems like it's been forever now. People enjoy Nebraska. They're always friendly. The fans are nice and they've been a power before. So there's always that, oh, it's a blue blood that could come back to life. So they start with UTEP, probably going to roll through that. Then they get a revenge rivalry game against Colorado in week two. And after last year, after, you know, Dion's, great start, they were able to boost themselves over the start of Matt Rule's tenure. And people were like, oh, wow, Colorado really is. Oh, my gosh, Ian, yeah, blah, 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 blah. So the ability, the hype machine that's going to be there, Colorado will have played, I believe, North Dakota State, probably beat them. But who knows? It's North Dakota State. It's not the last season, the last, you know, especially decades, North Dakota State, but it still is them. But assuming they get through, you're going to see this revenge game happening. And there's going to be a disproportionate amount of media attention on it. There just is. Warranted or not.
What?
Yeah. But then they get NIU, should be winnable. They get Illinois, probably winnable. Bielema, we'll see where that Illinois team is. At Purdue, Rutgers, at Indiana, they could be 7-0 before they head into Columbus to play Ohio State, which they're going to be one of a class. I mean, every season we've seen a team like this where they're like undefeated and you're like, yeah, but, you know, that kind of a team. But with Nebraska doing it, with Dylan Raiola, I mean, they might be halfway through building the statue when they go into Columbus. And that's going to be, I think, an entertaining thing to watch. I don't think it's all that bold, but my goodness, we're going to see it. Because and for those, just to finish out that schedule, we're talking about that. Then they host UCLA, go to at USC, Wisconsin, and then at Iowa. I mean, I think it's not a bold take to say that they're going to go bowling. I think they're going to go bowling. I think they could even make a good bowl. But I think the hype train is going to be absolutely off the rails by the end of October for Nebraska.
I'll give Nebraska fans this credit. It's actually kind of funny as somebody who obviously I've been open about it, right? Like, I didn't grow up in college football the same way that a lot of other people did. So, like, I wasn't watching a whole lot of 90s Nebraska or, like, early 2000s Nebraska. So I mostly know Nebraska fans as, like, oh, God. Oh, oh, I hope that we can fit. So, like, I feel like most Nebraska fans that I talk to, I'll make sure to get Max Olson on the horn. He'll be able to tell me great, of course. But I think that most Nebraska fans that I talk to are pretty much like, let's just make a bowl, man. I think that would be fine. I think that would be okay with me. Let's just make a bowl game. You said it. The schedule sets up pretty nicely for them to be able to do it. If they're 7-0 heading into Ohio State, I think we'll reach a fever pitch. And then they'll play that game and they'll immediately be like, okay. Finally, eyes are off us. I think that, thank goodness, we don't have to worry about a playoff. We don't want to be doing all of that. But, I think that they'd feel still really good about where they're at. I think you buried the lead, though. Do you think that when Nebraska plays against Xavier Smith and UTEP, that he's going to give them any pointers on dealing with Coach Prime's offense?
He'll appear on the sideline of that game, like, you know. Oh, my goodness.
You're going to get some Connor Stallion action going
on. Yeah, Connor Stallion style. My goodness.
Oh. No, but I do think, like, I don't want to overstate it, right? Like, I think Nebraska has a chance to be a good team next year. They should have been in a bowl game last year. Like, just straight up, they should have been. I think that the other piece too is that it's not a secret I'm a big Matt Rhule fan, and I think he does a good job of, like, building sustainable growth at the same time, right? Like, I don't think that he kind of rushes his process. I don't think he's going to, I mean, if they're 7-0, I don't think he's going to be talking crazy by any means, right? Like, I think that he's going to be like, yeah, you know, it's like, we're happy where we're at, but, like, we have a lot of work to, I think he's going to try to downplay it if they get to 7-0 going into Ohio State. But, like, I think they could easily win 8 games this year. And after the last couple of years, I think they'd have to feel really good about that, especially if Dylan Raiola is the face of it.
Yeah, if anything, it'll set up a crazy hype train for the following season. Then we're all going to hear it.
Yes, that's going to be the crazy one.
You know,
that's
going to go off the rails. In the 90s and in the aughts, like, their fans were known for being very, aw, shucks, you guys are going to be really good, knowing that their team is going to just destroy you. So that was actually the Nebraska fandom. That was what they were famous. They applauded the opposing team as they left the field at the end of the game, usually after being absolutely obliterated. That was their game.
That's so funny because, of course, SEC fans are known for, like, being cutthroat and crazy and fanatical and all this sort of stuff. And there are some Big Ten fan bases that fly under the radar with that. Like, I think that it was hilarious that Caitlin Clark happened at Iowa, because that's, like, a low-key program that's insane. That their fans are off the wall. That's interesting to hear that Nebraska, even in their heyday, was kind of like, nah, we're good. But, of course, like you said, it's easier to do that when your program just wins
everything. Being magnanimous. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's actually, as being somebody who grew up in the Big 12, Oklahoma fans were a lot happier and nicer before, like, 2021.
You know, as we slowly wrap this up, I have one quick question for you. So this is more of another practical reporting thing, because I'm going to Oregon. I've mentioned it a few times, Southern Oregon, to go see a game between Japan's college football champ playing an NAIA team. But it's supposed to rain the whole game, and they don't really have a traditional they have a box, but it's for, you know, it's for the coordinators, it's for the staff, it's for, like, the one guy who helps them, you know, with other stuff. So I'm going to be on the sideline during a rainy game, and I have lots of weatherproof clothing, but it's for Minnesota, and if I wore that on the sidelines, I would probably be melting. What would you do? I mean, have you ever had to do that, cover a game where it's really rainy, you're outside? What are your go-to clothing items for this?
Well, I think, first of all, I am very spoiled because primarily I deal with Power 5 facility. So I'm doing great. I remember back in 2017, I don't know if people outside of the footprint remember that Baylor TCU game where it stormed the entire time. No, sorry, that was the 2015 game is what I'm thinking of. And it was a huge game and it just stormed and everybody was miserable and it was freezing. And I was just chilling up there in the press box. I did just fine. But I think the biggest thing to think about is what content are you hoping to get from the game and what do you need to have to make it happen? So like, for example, from my perspective, like, it would be like, okay, I have to find a way to take notes or whatever that is still in like the, you know, what it, definitely find like what you're allowed to bring, right? Like if you're allowed to bring a small umbrella or if you're allowed, whatever it is, right? The other piece though too, like, what's the temperature going to be like up there? It's going to be like in the 50s?
50 degrees and rainy cold. It's going to be one of those days.
Okay, it's going to be one of those. So, I mean, I think it's very important, and you're of course a Midwesterner, so I know that you know all about this. It's very important to layer, right? Oh, yeah. So like you want to have some like warmer layers, but you also want to have the rainproof layer right on top of things. And so whether it's a poncho, I think that some people like to go the poncho because you get some like freedom of movement with it, or if you just get a traditional raincoat, I think that both of those are good plans. So that's my biggest advice. You want to come in and you want to figure out, can I have an umbrella? Can I have an awning of some sort? And what do I need to do to make it happen?
We'll see how I'm on Monday. Monday, my voice might be telling, I'm like, I can't believe how wet it was. I barely, I think
can't
I have
be as bad as being Post Malone in Vegas.
Oh my goodness. Well, thank you all for listening. This was a fun show. I've got to talk a lot about the things going on. Again, as I said, it's May. This is usually the quietest time of the season historically, but there's always stuff to talk about now. And it's always interesting. And I love that about college football. Although, again, it is nice to take breaks when we get them. But on behalf of all of us, we want to thank you for listening. We want to thank our producer, Joey Aliberti. Be sure to like, rate, and subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us on X and TikTok at CFB Survivor Show. He's Shehan Jeyaraja. You can find his work at CBS Sports and at Shehan Jeyaraja on Twitter and TikTok. Be sure to check out the articles he's got going, as he mentioned, on CBS Sports. I mean, it'll be interesting to see his takes, his big predictions and bold predictions for the Big 12. I'm Bob Akairi, a part of the team that runs at Reddit CFB on Twitter. Thanks for listening, everyone. Have a good one.
The College Football Survivor Show, where playoff survival is always on the line.